Okay, let's turn to these questions, and I wanted to raise this, and then I'll use the question because it makes the point. Donna, no question that, look, the Democratic Party has historically been the party of working men and women, families, going back to the New Deal. And obviously in this last election, a lot of those voters were lost, angry, frustrated, Rust Belt, you know the problems. How did the Democrats lose those votes, and what can the Democrats do to be able to sharpen their focus and try to regain those voters?
That's a good question. I think one of the big mistakes of 2016, and look, I've been very open about the mistakes I saw, was that we didn't communicate with them. We sort of took those voters for granted. We also took those states for granted. I mean, five out of the last six elections, Democrats have relied on the so-called blue wall, the 242 electoral votes that we received from 18 states in the District of Columbia. And if you happen to be a voter in one of those states, well, guess what? You didn't hear from us. We didn't communicate with you. You didn't hear our plan for job creation. You didn't hear our plans for college affordability. And as a result of it, I think many of you decided to either stay at home or, in the worst case, you decided to go with Donald Trump. And you saw a precipitous drop in the support of blue-collar whites in the Rust Belt that voted for Obama. So you can't call them racist. I used to get upset with people who would walk in my office and say, oh, they're racist. I said, bullshit. Oh, did I say that? And look, you would think after 40 days of Lent and washing my mouth out with Cabernet, I would be better. But the point is that we ignored them. And their pain and their frustration, their concerns, their hopes, their aspiration. They found hope in Obama's message, both in 2008 and 2012. They didn't hear our message. And we didn't just fail them. Many of them decided that they couldn't stomach the party. The party had no message for their future. And I think part of what the Democratic Party has to do in the future is to find a way to talk to them. Look, we cannot ignore the base of the party. I mean, it's like making a gumbo. You gotta have a roux. Those of you who know how to stir understand what I'm saying. You gotta have a roux. But you also have to make sure that those essential ingredients that appeal to blue-collar voters, I think those essential ingredients will also appeal to the millennials, especially minority millennials, who are going to be such a large part of the Democratic Party's base if the party is going to have a future. And it depends on the party now reaching out to them, because 2018 is a huge election year, and we cannot wait to 2020. I'm sorry, folks, where we have about 50 different candidates, half of them from California, who are anticipating that they will run. We have to start now if we're going to build a party that is going to be attractive to the vast majority of the American people.
Can I just add, I mean, one word on that? I mean, I was not a big fan of Trump, and I certainly didn't expect him to win the Republican nomination. I was totally wrong about that. I always said in August, September, October, when I was on TV, I thought there was, you know, a 1 in 4 chance or something that he'd win the general election. He was behind in the polls. I didn't expect him to win, but I always thought there was a chance. And that was from the lesson I took from way back in 1992 when I was in the first Bush White House. George H.W. Bush was actually a pretty good president. You know, I think historians will say he entered the Cold War successfully. We had a budget deal, which Lee Hunt was part of, which I think put the country on a better path in terms of the deficit. We had a recession, but we came out of that in 92, passed some good bipartisan legislation, the Americans with Disabilities Act, the Clean Air Act. But people want to change. And in 92, we were just so frustrated in the Bush White House. I think the first President Bush almost couldn't believe what was happening. He had done what he viewed as the key, he had fulfilled the key function of a president, which is managing the national security affairs of the country. He thought he'd done a pretty good job on domestic policy too, but you can't really control the business cycle. He kind of assumed he would win against Bill Clinton, some, you know, governor from Arkansas who was an attractive guy and a sort of centrist Democrat, but didn't seem to be necessarily, took at least wait 4 years, you know, I think President Bush thought. And we got clobbered. I mean, think about it. Bush had 54% of the vote in 1988 when he won as Reagan's vice president, 38% of the vote in 92. He was not, as I say, a bad president, but we lost 16% of our 54, about one of every three or four voters. And what that, going through that election campaign, which was so frustrating, taught me is if people want change, they want change. And they don't want to hear a lot of reasons about why change is risky and you shouldn't want change. And Obama was a pretty good president and Hillary would continue the Obama agenda, but even better, but without getting into too many details. And, you know, people wanted change for whatever reason. And maybe it was because of stagnation of working class and middle class incomes over 10, 20 years. And maybe it was because of the many other things that were going on. And I do think Hillary just never, the campaign, maybe she couldn't have, she'd been around a long time, but she just never was able to get it all ahead of the sentiment for change. That Trump really did see. I mean, he really capitalized on that. And people were willing to take a pretty big risk and go with Trump. I think it was too much of a risk. They didn't appreciate that, you know, how much they were putting things at risk. We'll see what happens over the next 3 years. But I do think that the tapping into the sentiment of change was big. It's just hard to be, it was hard to be Hillary Clinton, to be fair to the Hillary Clinton campaign. She was in a tough structural position. The Democrats had the White House for 8 years. The White House tends to turn over after 8 years. The middle class, working class incomes had been stagnant. The center of the country hadn't done well. And the party seemed sort of disconnected from white working class voters. And Trump was able to eke out a very narrow victory, kind of an inside straight. With the winds of change at his back.
Don, let me ask you, just following up on that. In the book Shattered, it's pretty critical of the Clinton campaign in a number of ways, but the one area that I'd like to ask you about is that there was growing concern among a number of people about what was happening in Michigan, what was happening in Wisconsin, what was happening in some of these states, and the concern was that Hillary Clinton should spend more time in those states. But there was this formulaic approach that said we can basically use the Obama formula, the Obama turnout, and that will suffice. If Hillary had spent more time in those states, would it have made it a difference?
Yes. I do think that there is one way of looking at the campaign. When you look at, again, the 78,000 some odd votes that Donald Trump was able to secure and therefore win Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, those votes, ladies and gentlemen, and you just go back and look at the data. I look at the data. It's Detroit, it's Oakland, it's Flint, Michigan. If you look at Michigan, it's Milwaukee, some of the suburbs there. And it's Philadelphia and some of the outer counties. She not only missed the mark and underperformed with white working class voters, white college educated women, which I personally think that was the Comey effect.
Yeah.
Because white college educated women did a drop right after the Comey letter. The Comey letter to Congress that was leaked and blah, blah, blah. But she underperformed with African Americans by 5%, with Hispanics by 6%, Asian Pacific Islanders by 8%. So there were other mitigating factors out there. And again, I continue to believe that we prolonged the primary in the Democratic Party. We didn't unify the party. The party came to the convention, Senator Sanders embraced Secretary Clinton, but there was still a lot of tension within the party. And, you know, just think about it. 3 weeks out, 2 weeks out, many voters cast their ballots early. We also had a situation where people say, oh, well, Hillary's going to win, so I can vote third party. This was the largest third party vote since the 1992 election. So that was another factor. But look, the Clinton campaign was data centric. I am so old now. I now know my age. Okay, now my ex-boss created and invented the internet. He inspired it. Okay, that's Al Gore. And all of a sudden, we're in the internet age, and I'm like, can we talk to people? I mean, can we talk to actual living human beings, voters? No, we have now categorized everybody in this room as some cluster of America that we don't talk to you. You're already, you're going to vote. Oh, are you a black woman?
Mm-hmm.
Don't talk to you. 96% of you going to vote for Hillary. I said, 96%, but what's the turnout? And then, of course, I kept stressing my Irish roots. People look at this black skin and say, you just black. No, I'm Irish too. can you
Donna
can
has
you
a very active fantasy life.
No,
she has another glass of wine. Who knows where this
goes? I haven't had my first one a day yet, Bill. You should see me in a couple hours. But no, the point is that I've worked on enough campaigns to know that you have to talk to people. You can't depend on computer models of voters. And what Trump did, I would go to Western PA. Now, I used to tell people in the Obama years I was Jewish. See, I promise. Well, every 2 years I can reinvent myself, okay? But this year I was the angry white male. I would come back and I said, there are no posters. What do you mean? We don't need posters. We're going to win that area by 52% of the vote. And when I went to Scranton, no posters. Now, I don't know about you, but everybody needs a poster. Donald Trump had no people in his headquarters but posters. Hillary had people in her headquarters but no posters. Which team won? The team with no people, because they were out there in the street passing out posters. So the point I'm making is that you have to constantly communicate with voters. You can't take them for granted. And the Obama coalition, which was a very powerful coalition, we all thought that the demographics of the Democratic Party would carry us to 270. That failed us, because we didn't talk to the voters that we needed to get out. And they didn't have that message that needed. But I have to say this, I got a but. She still got the popular vote. Yeah. And I got to say one more thing. And despite all of the misogyny and the sexism and the things that no other presidential candidate had to talk about, I still believe that most Americans, as you saw in the exit polls, they thought she was more than qualified to be president and was well prepared. So this wasn't the moment, but the moment will come. We will get our first female president, and I'm going to be around to help.
David.
I look forward to Donna working on the Nikki Haley campaign.
I'm gonna put my glasses on now.
All right. let me get control of this. David, how has the president's use of social media changed the role of the press? And, you know, again, it's obviously the president's use of tweeting as a way to kind of get to his constituents, get around mainstream press. How do future presidents communicate with the American people in the age of social media?
Well, I hope they'll start treating them like adults again. We'll have to wait and see. But listen, I think that the Donald Trump, you have to recognize that he did bring strengths to the campaign that were lacking on the other side. And one is he understood the conditions and the agonies and anxieties of middle America a lot better than Hillary did and a lot better than the Democratic Party did. So he gave voice to the kind of alienation that you see out there that has come from years of people feeling like they've been marginalized and that the system is rigged against them. They think the Democratic Party has rigged the system in favor of minorities and the Republican Party has rigged it in favor of the rich, and they're the ones left out. You know, I think Trump got that and understood it. It also is true that he's made much more aggressive use of the internet, especially of Twitter, obviously, but in many, many other ways, the Republicans ran a superior organization on the internet. I happen to think it has led to a decline in the discourse of the country, that we're not having honest debates, that it has opened the door to a flood of fake Twitter accounts and fake arguments. And there are people out there who are trolling, who are paid to troll, who are paid to do false things. It's opened the door to fake news. And we're all suffering from not knowing what's true and what's not true. But in the process of that, what it's done is it's taken the mainstream media and made them seem like part of the problem, not part of the solution. That increasingly this campaign that they've been waging on social media coming out of the Trump White House is one intended to discredit the press, the mainstream press. Because if you can get them to the point of view that they're just seen as partisan hacks, then there's everything they say can be dismissed and like, you know, this doesn't count because they're just out to get you anyway. I can tell you, I saw early versions of that, but way back with in the Nixon days. I worked in the White House during the Watergate period as a young kid, and that's essentially what the Nixon people tried to do, what Nixon was doing, what Haldeman was doing, you know, what John Mitchell was doing. They were discrediting the Washington Post, discrediting Woodward and Bernstein, discrediting every institution that could attack them, and I think they have been pretty darn successful. So that, you know, the respect for the press today is at a very low level. If, you know, can the press come out of this? Yes, but that's one of the reasons I said early on, we've got to not seem that we're in a fox hunt and that Trump is a fox. You know, that I think only plays into the narrative that the left has taken hold of the press and it is to be discredited, and what you can read on social media is really where the news is. I happen to think that the fake news that came out from the Russians Hillary did pay a serious price for that. After the Comey came out in October, as he did, there was an explosion of fake news saying she's going to jail. Vote for Hillary, she's a man going to jail. You can't trust this. And I think it was very, very destructive. And one of the issues in front of us as a people is, how do we restore some conversation among us that's serious, that is led by the people like Bill Kristol? I mean, you know, his voice ought to be one of the most important in the nation, but he shouldn't have to compete with blogs that are false or people are throwing things around. And frankly, one of the things we need to do to our kids is we got to get their heads out of their electronics. You know, the latest surveys show that young millennials now are spending as much as one third of their time on electronics. I'm an abuser myself, but there's an addiction that's going on with our kids, and there's been a 40% decrease in empathy. 40% decrease in empathy over the last 15 years. The kind of discourse we're having in our politics is what's going on among kids generally, and it's very dangerous for the future of the country.
Leon, I just want to say something. October 7th, anybody remember October 7th? October 7th was the night the Access Hollywood tape came out, grab her by the genitals. It was also the night that WikiLeaks made a huge dump of John Podesta's emails, including his risotto recipe. October 7th also happened to be the day when I believe 16 of the intelligent agencies collectively said that the Russians were interfering. So that story got about 2 million hits on Twitter and social media, Facebook, et cetera. The grab her by the genitals, 5 million. WikiLeaks, up to 22 million. And so what do you think when I went on TV that Sunday? Bill, I don't think you were on that Sunday with me.
I don't know.
What did we talk about? Podesta's emails, okay? And I said something, well, I wouldn't read anything postmarked from Russia. Why did I say that? Boy, the next day, WikiLeaks found me, and Donald Trump found me, and I have not gotten so many 140 words tweets in my life. And then the bots and the trolls. I'm telling you, we elected a black president, nobody trolled me. Nobody gave me a bot. I got called the N-word once or twice, but I never received threatening emails. The incivility of the internet just went bonkers. So we have to be careful, especially when we now have paid services that you can target, again, cluster of voters. And through Facebook, through Twitter, and all of these other useful tools. So this is something that this is another lesson that we should take away from the 2016 election to protect us in the future. I was saying earlier, I've been to both the Netherlands, France, and I was in Germany last week. And the Germans are already, all of the political parties are sitting down and they are now figuring out how to deal with the hacking that has occurred already. And they know that this information, this disinformation may be put out before the election in September. But the political parties are working together. We need to do that in this country to avoid that from happening again.
Bill Kristol, as a fellow shell-shocked Republican, what advice does Bill Kristol have for conservatives cast adrift by a new Republican Party?
Yeah. I think it would be nice to take back the Republican Party and recommit it to conservative principles. As I say this, the good news for me, the irony is one's view is so distorted by Donald Trump in a certain sense. He's such a huge figure. He's president of the United States, 45th president. He won such a surprise victory. He takes up all the oxygen in the room, obviously. But in the middle, I remember in 2015, being on a panel and saying truthfully, and I think this was true, that I had never been more optimistic about the Republican Party. In 2014, the class of 2014 of senators and congressmen who were sent to Washington was an excellent class. It was young. The Republican conference in the Senate is about and the House is about 7 years younger than the Democrats. They have 32, I think, governors. A lot of them are very impressive. A lot of them are in states that are not normal Republican states. They're doing very well. Charlie Baker in Massachusetts, Larry Hogan in Maryland, as well as others in Midwestern states, and then in the South where you'd expect them more. A lot of the members of Congress the last several, I mean, if you look at the Republican Party, if you went to SSA, if you could party with Rubio and Cory Gardner and Joni Ernst and Dan Sullivan and Tom Cotton and Ben Sasse, and you look at those senators and you think, well, that's a pretty, not a bad future, and there's some diversity of opinions. The youngest woman ever elected to the House, Elise Stefanik, whom I knew as a, when she was a Howard undergraduate, gets elected from upstate New York and at age 31. Mike Gallagher from Wisconsin, age 33. There's some good young Democrats who've come along. Jimmy Panetta is one of them. Seth Moulton from Massachusetts, the last cycle, too. So but it's weird. If you just took away Trump, I would say this is not a party. I mean, they do control both houses of Congress, 32 governor's mansions, two-thirds of the state legislatures. It's not, you wouldn't necessarily say this is a party in crisis. And it's a party with more diversity, Nikki Haley, Rubio, et cetera, Tim Scott. I mean, it's not quite where it should be, but it's getting there. But Trump does distort everything. And the truth is, it's a little bit of a fluke that he's president, honestly. He ran a clever campaign. He was very, very lucky in the opponents he had. He had, if you have a country that's unhappy with the ruling, the way things have gone for the last 20, 25 years, and you're an outsider insurgent candidate, what you want to do is to run against a Bush and then a Clinton, right? I mean, it's like you couldn't set it up better, right? You know, the two families that have sort of run the country, basically, for the last 25, 30 years, Trump had them as his opponents, main opponents in the primary and then the general. So he drew the inside straight, he won the Electoral College, though losing the popular vote. But that doesn't answer the question, because the truth is he is president, and that has its own effects. It can be sort of fluky that he became president, but once he's president. And so for me, that's a huge question. And it comes down, I think, a lot of it to the Republican Congress. They are the actual elected federal officials who are elected on their own. It's not a parliamentary system. They don't run on a ticket with Trump. I mean, they may literally run on the ballot with Trump, but they have their own races. More Republican congressmen and senators than not ran ahead of Donald Trump in 2016. So it's not as if they came in on Trump's coattails. Even in states where he surprised, Wisconsin, where he won by 2 or 3, Ron Johnson won by 7. So, I mean, but so far I would say they've been very deferential to President Trump. Sort of inevitable, I suppose, when the president of your own party comes in, you want him to succeed, they want to work with him. They want to achieve real policy objectives. They also want to be able to help shape his administration, so they don't want to break with him. I understand all that. But I do think the future of the Republican Party, and to some degree the conservative movement, does depend on Republicans on the Hill not letting it simply be Trump's party. They don't have to be as anti-Trump as I am, but they can't just look like apologists and rationalizers of Donald Trump, in my view. I think short term, you might do a little better at home. You'll have less people angry at you at a town meeting. You'll have fewer phone calls from angry Republicans at your Hill office, or either in Washington or back in the district. But medium and long term, that is not a path, in my view, for success for the Republicans. So will Republican congressmen and senators try to establish a Republican future that's separate from Donald Trump? It's not so easy to do, because the president takes up an awful lot of space in our system. That's the question for me. But I'd say, and this is something we were talking about before, and maybe I'd love to hear what others have to say about this, I do think now for the first time since I came to Washington that the possibility of the two-party system fracturing, the possibility of an independent candidate for president, or maybe independent candidates at some of the state level, of the Republican Party becoming a Trump Party, the Democratic Party becoming, let's oversimplify, a Sanders Party, and an awful lot of room being left in the middle. There are a lot of reasons why the American two-party system has sustained itself all these years. There are a lot of impediments to independent candidates and third parties, but I really wonder, I don't think it's out of the question, that if the Republican Party goes in a Trump direction and the Democratic Party goes in a radical direction, you could end up with an independent, you could end up with, for the first time in a long time, a serious challenge to the two-party system. So I'm not so sure what the future of the Republican Party is.
All right. David, we've often talked about the dysfunction in Washington, the inability. I mean, you and I, Bill, Donna, I think, remember when Republicans and Democrats worked together on issues and developed a lot of landmark legislation. That was the best of Washington that I saw, and the good news was that Washington worked. We now have a Washington in which you've got very divided parties, very partisan parties, and an inability to work together to get legislation through. This question is, how can the press educate the partisan voters to accept compromise to get to yes?
How can the press educate?
This is a question about the press
educating. And education in the same sentence?
How do we, let me give you a broader question.
How do we encourage?
How do we fix this damn thing? How do we get Republicans and Democrats to work together again?
Well, I think it's a given that the polarization now has reached levels we have not seen in our lifetimes. We actually have people now who choose the neighborhood that they want to live in, partly by whether they're Republicans and they want to live in a red neighborhood or Democrats looking for a blue neighborhood. We have people who say, I don't want my son or daughter to marry somebody who comes from the other party. I mean, it's literally true now. And I am less and less persuaded that the generation now in power and leadership positions is the generation that's going to fix this. You know, I think the baby boom generation has turned out to be a disappointment, generally speaking, in terms of governance. There have been some, you know, some good things that have happened, but this has been a generation that's been splintered since the 1960s. The Vietnam War put an axe down the middle of this generation. You know, there are a lot of the social turmoil of the 60s, people went their own ways, depending where they went to college, and I just don't think we've ever come back together in a way to govern. What I do think is very hopeful is the generation is coming, of which your son Jimmy is a part. And Bill and I have talked about this today. I've seen, you know, just through the classroom and now working with some of these, the number of young people now who want to come off the sidelines and get into politics is stunning. We've had a real spike here in the last 4 or 5 months. Emily's list has had a real spike in the number of women who want to run. The enrollment in Emily's list has gone up. But I'm personally working now with a group of veterans to see if we can get young veterans like Jimmy, get a group of them elected. And Bill mentioned two who are among my favorites. One's a Democrat, Seth Moulton, who's a center-left Democrat, and the other is a young Republican who's a veteran, Mike Gallagher from Wisconsin, who's a center-right Republican. And I'm part of a group right now called New Politics that is trying to raise money and encourage. We have 20 veterans who are planning to run in 2018, and they're running for the Congress. And the notion is, if you can get a group of young veterans to come in who are very committed to working across the aisle, that's part of what they, you know, believe in going in, you could potentially create a swing vote in the House. And it, you know, it would not be the Freedom Caucus that provides the determining votes. It would be a more centrist and center-right, center-left coalition that does that. And I think that's the future. I see a growing number of these young people who are doing amazing things for the country, who hate our politics, but they're either social entrepreneurs or they're coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan and saying, listen, getting into politics can't be any harder than what I just did. And they because they fought under the same flag, they have a sense that they belong to the same community, that they want to belong to the same America, and they really come back here with the notion is, I haven't seen this since the Second World War generation. You know, that Tom Brokaw called it the greatest generation, not only because they won the war, because they were the greatest civic generation when they came home. You know, they really got engaged in trying to, you know, run the country well, and I think we had a string of very good presidents with Harry Truman and Dwight Eisenhower and starting that off. And today I think that there is this real possibility, and I can just tell you story after story of these young veterans coming out whom I think can be at the leading vanguard of bringing change in our politics that is rooted and goes beyond the press. It's a change in our culture. That's what we really need. These questions are cultural, not just particular campaigns. It's how people live together. And that's why I think ultimately, Leon, when you started off in Passé and our institutions are being tested, I think we, the citizens of the country, are being tested now too. And I think it's not just a question of leaving it up to Washington to fix all this. I think it's a question of us taking back the fate of the country and getting things done at the local level, getting things done at the community level, getting things done at the state level. I think we'd have to wait an awful long time if we just want to depend on the people in Washington today.
Okay. I've got about 3 or 4 minutes left, and I'd like each of you to just, you know, give me your sense of what you think is going to happen in 2018 with the election. We've got a 2018 election in which, actually, if you look at the paper score sheet, the Democrats are vulnerable because of the seats in the Senate, where more of the Democratic seats are up. In the House side, we know that only about 40 seats are competitive out of 535. Considering kind of the Trump presidency, and let's assume that this investigation keeps going on, if you put that into your calculation, what do you think will happen in the 2018 election? Will the Democrats do a sweep? Will it be a Watergate class, or will it be something different? Bill, let me start with you.
Obviously, one thing we should have learned in the last year and a half is not to make these predictions. I mean, just again, looking at it as a political scientist, it is very hard to become, if you become president and your party controls Congress, which was the situation with Clinton in 93, it was the situation of Obama in 2008, it was the situation of Bush in 2000, except Bush was actually very lucky. They lost the Senate 6 months in 2001, which actually helped him, I think, in the off year. Basically, it's bad news. If you control everything, it's bad news because you're held responsible. People have high expectations. Usually, those get disappointed. I think they're likely to be disappointed by this president and this Republican Congress. So I think 2018 will be a sort of classic off-year election where I think Democrats will win, more likely than not, will win the House. The Senate's very, very tough just because of the map for the Democrats. You could end up with a 50-50 Senate or something like that. And I would say just on this last point about partisanship, I have a slightly contrarian view. Maybe it's just a hope. I do think we'll go through a hyper-partisan period here for the next few months, and Trump will try to govern. I think it's a little crazy, frankly, but with 52 Republican senators in a very partisan way, I don't think it's going to work too well. And there will be a moment, maybe it'll be the after the fiscal year, after September 30th, before the next State of the Union, where people are going to look up and say, well, what is going on here? Can't we work together on some things? We can't resolve the entire healthcare system of the country. We can't resolve the entire budget. Can't we deal with the opioid crisis? Can't we deal with job training? Can't we deal with two or three concrete things? And I would think there'll be an opportunity, maybe not for leadership, but for more junior senators and congressmen to get together and really begin to sort of shake things up in a way that we haven't seen for a while.
Okay, Donna,
28. I'm very optimistic. I mean, first of all, what else can we lose? I've seen so much blood on the floor. I'm just, trust me. Republicans control so much territory, 2/3 of state houses, the governors, Congress. And despite the fact that we have so many red state Democrats up, Claire McCaskill, Joe Connolly, Missouri, Indiana, of course, Montana. Who knew we even had a Democrat? And then North Dakota, West Virginia.
Donna.
These are good Democrats. So I think the Democrats are going to come back, and we're going to come back with state houses and then the Congress.
David, give me the quick 30-second shot.
Okay. The Senate stays Republican. The big race is in the House. If some of his associates get nailed between now and the election, this is going to shape up, and not much happens on jobs. This will shape up, 2018 election will shape up as, is he going to be impeached or not? Because if the Democrats take back the House, I will tell you, if the evidence is there, they are ready to start impeachment proceedings. I don't think they can get it through the Senate, but I do think it'll bring a Donnybrook in our politics.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, I wish you thank our speakers, but most importantly, I think the message tonight is that all of you need to continue to stay active in our democracy so that we can find a path to the future. Thank you very much for having us, and thank you for speaking.